If you were on Twitter yesterday, you saw all the negativity being tweeted and retweeted. It was a dumpster fire. There was just so much bad behavior by humans. Think about the crowded pools in the Ozarks, protesters yelling at people wearing masks, a black man in New York City threatened with having the cops called on him for asking someone to obey the rules in Central Park, and another black man killed by a cop in Minnesota. As the author Rebecca Solnit recently wrote in The Guardian, one of the biggest cliches about disasters is they reveal civilization as a thin veneer beneath which lies brutal human nature. But before you let despair set in, think about what Solnit also observes. She went on to write that research shows, quote, the great majority of people in ordinary disasters behave in ways that are anything but selfish. Solnit is quoted in a piece from New Yorker staff writer Gia Tolentino titled What Mutual Aid Can Do During a Pandemic. The term mutual aid, which has been used to describe small, localized acts of solidarity and reciprocity within communities, has changed to meet this moment. Is this fleeting or will it have lasting effects? Let's talk about it with Gia Tolentino. Gia, welcome back to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
So you write that the peak of mutual aid organizing in American history may have come in the late 60s and early 70s, when street transvestite action revolutionaries opened a shelter for homeless trans youth in New York. The Black Panther Party started a free breakfast program. Why is it important to think about the current surge in mutual aid networks against the backdrop of that history?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think we're seeing in the coronavirus pandemic, it is a radicalizing moment for many people, similar to that period in the late 60s, where we're seeing, you know, the way that communities that are suffering are communities that have always been neglected by the state. Mm-hmm. And it's in these communities that the tradition of mutual aid, which was first laid out as the political concept by the Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin in 1902, it's in these communities that this principle of direct aid in the absence of anything the state's going to do for you, you know, that all we have is each other and what we can do for each other. It's in these communities around the world and in America that these structures of direct aid have been built. And it was fascinating to me to see, you know, as soon, even before the country went on full lockdown, how organizers who have been radicalized in previous moments started coming together to be like, how are we going to get each other through this?
What did you observe is different about the role of mutual aid now as compared to during events like after Hurricane Katrina or after Sandy?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that's, you know, it's interesting comparing the coronavirus pandemic to other disasters, right? Mm-hmm. It's a unique one because, you know, with a hurricane, with something like that, you have a crisis and then it's over and then you help people in the aftermath. For us, we're living the crisis and the consequences all at once for an indefinite amount of time, right? And so there was something very different about the way that these organizations were structuring themselves, where organizers were getting together in mid-March and saying, okay, you know, we're going to have to help the disabled. We're going to have to help our elderly. We're going to have to be doing it for months. You know, there was a way in which people were thinking about long-term infrastructure in a way that is, you know, distinct from other disaster relief efforts.
You make the point, though, that mutual aid thrives on sustained personal relationships. And you're right, but the coronavirus has necessitated that relationships be built online. So how is this moment forcing people to innovate and reinvent what mutual aid looks like?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that's been interesting is that certain, you know, some activist communities, like disability activists, have had to learn how to organize virtually for a long time, right? Have had to be creative about organizing. And it was, I found it really wonderful to see how these sort of toolkits that activists had built were getting shared online and in Google Docs. And so, yeah, this was a fascinating moment in organizing where in that mid-March period, people were sharing spreadsheets, just copying and modeling efforts on each other in ways that were sort of viral. Like the one group that I spoke to and that I profiled in the piece was these medical students in Minnesota had been, you know, cut from their clinical rotations and their classes. And within like 3 days, they had put together, like over Zoom, a group of about 15 of them who had never met, started calling themselves the COVID sitters and put together a free childcare, you know, kind of 24-hour anytime program for medical workers in their communities. And they organized it over Zoom. And And that's different. And, you know, a lot of these mutual aid efforts, a lot of these new community organizations, they were themselves going viral on social media in a new way. And I think even the term mutual aid, it was surprising to me, but it was popularized because it describes a fundamentally radical political idea, but it went viral on the internet.
My guest is Gia Tolentino. She wrote a piece called What Mutual Aid Can Do During a Pandemic for The New Yorker. So one of the groups that comes up in your piece is Bed-Stuy Strong, founded in March 2020. What struck you about the way Bed-Stuy Strong is structured and run?
Yeah, so this organization, which at first I'd heard of because a couple of my friends joined, and then basically it seemed like all of my friends were starting to deliver groceries for this group. You know, it's an interesting moment. There's a mutual aid as a principle. Organizers really very firmly strive to differentiate solidarity from charity, right? That mutual aid isn't community service just because it's good to do community service, right? That it's teaching people how to meet each other's needs and how to meet their own needs in a way that will allow you to push back on the structures that created this inequality that we're seeing highlighted in a crisis like this and with every natural disaster. And it's interesting to see, you know, new organizations can fall on a wide spectrum of, you know, this is sort of thinking it's sort of apolitical work, just like don't bring politics into it. It's just neighbors helping neighbors versus, you know, some groups, and Bed-Stuy Strong was one of them, you know, from the beginning was like, you know, we're going to prioritize zero hierarchy and decentralized decision making. And we are not going to, you know, one of the big things that differentiates solidarity from charity is that, you know, there's no criteria for who gets helped. It's like, we'll help anyone that asks, no questions asked. And, you know, there was a way that Bed-Stuy Strong from the beginning was working on these principles. Like, we will get your groceries for free. We don't need you to prove that you have need. You know, we will structure this organization in a way that the group, the volunteers, will make the decisions. It will not be a top-down model. And that struck me as indicative of something about this moment where, you know, a lot of people who were activists in Occupy, you know, are bringing their skills and their organizational priorities to this moment. And I think that the, you know, this sort of decentralized, like truly cooperative decision-making structure is something that a lot of groups are focusing on now.
If you go to Bed-Stuy Strong's site, they have a list of principles. They say, we move in solidarity, we do the work humbly, we hold space for joyful, compassionate, imaginative, we are accountable to each other. So my question is, you mentioned how they want to be decentralized and it's sort of a cooperative, not specifically about Bed-Stuy, but I don't know if you looked into this all. What happens when there's disagreement inside
mutual aid
group?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there are always disagreements in this group. And for example, like one of the things I wrote about in the piece was that, you know, there, in terms of just the political argument underlying direct aid, there is often a disagreement about, you know, whether mutual aid work is doing what the state should be responsible for, you know, the sort of socialist statist idea theory of change versus the anarchist-leaning one, which is mutual aid is all we have. Like, we should never rely on the state. And so there's always, you know, every activist movement is full of conflict, and that is productive, ultimately, and that's part of the work. And I think that, you know, in practice, what it means is just working these things out in public, right, transparently, that disagreement is understood as a right and almost a necessity and something that, you know, that people are welcome to continue to engage in as a process, and then sort of the group's priorities are what the group decides it should be.
My guest is Gia Tolentino. The name of her piece is What Mutual Aid Can Do During a Pandemic. So a lot of these founders of these groups tend to be politically active. We're going to talk to two after the break. When you talk to people who are politically active and part of mutual aid groups, do they connect their politics to the work, or do they compartmentalize them?
I think it's necessarily political, you know. I think it's mutual aid is distinct from other forms of, you know, like we were saying, community service and charity, in that it fundamentally involves this element of political education, or it properly should involve this element of political education and activism. And, you know, and the thing is, like, this sort of work is political no matter what, you know. There are, in many ways, like, it directly highlights A, what the state's not doing, and sometimes the kind of actions that the state criminalizes, you know. Mutual aid work, like, there are a lot of cities in the states that criminalize various forms of feeding the homeless. You know, there are activist groups who provide supplies to border crossers who have been tried on federal charges, you know. So I think this work, for the most part, people who are really steeped in, you know, wanting this to be solidarity, not charity, I mean, it's an inherently political concept, and it should be.
So, you know, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pops up in the piece a few times, mm-hmm. and she talked about her mutual aid, how she talks about mutual aid work. Do her actions suggest that mutual aid and federal government can work together, can overlap?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sometimes they can. You know, when I was, for example, the Minnesota healthcare worker babysitter collective, the state, you know, they have a Democratic governor. They have free child care for medical workers in Minnesota. But often what this child care collective is covering is, you know, weekends, nights, right? And so there are plenty of cases in which the state and the, you know, mutual aid networks can work in concert. But I think one thing that has been coming up lately, and that Ocasio-Cortez tweeted about recently too, is that a lot of people are kind of considering the limits of electoral politics being the way that we're told that will fix things, right? That, you know, you vote once a year, once every 2 years, once every 4 years, and that's how you make change. I think a lot of people are understanding that, you know, maybe like the time for that idea to be sufficient is done. And you know, what we need to do is to start creating the world we want right now, every day, with the people who are just geographically closest to us. And there's some traction that idea has been getting lately in a new way.
The name of the piece is What Mutual Aid Can Do During a Pandemic. It was written by Gia Tolentino. It is in The New Yorker. As always, Gia, thank you so much for joining us.
So good to talk to you.